Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Hi, everybody. We welcome you back to Close Up Talk Radio, wherever you may be listening. We're excited today because Dr. James Obney is back with us. He's been a guest with us here on Close Up Talk Radio several times now. He's a doctor who has spent his entire life preparing to run a medical system, and he is a practicing cardiothoracic surgeon who is highly skilled in robotic surgery. By the way, he holds a Master of Jurisprudence in Healthcare Law, Policy, and Management from Texas A&M University School of Law. And by the way, he served 17 years in the military, and he is passionate about learning. He always loves to learn something new. It's interesting, he has written that one of his first rotations in medical school was on cardiothoracic surgery. And when he walked into the OR, he saw a human chest wide open, and he even saw a beating heart. But it could have been chest surgery he was doing or back surgery involving thoracic, involving what is known as robotic surgery. My question is to Dr. Obney, if he were doing that today or going in there today, the scene would have been a lot different. If it, let's say it was lung surgery, you would not have seen the body split wide open with a beating heart because you don't have to do that in robotic surgery, do you, Dr. Obney?
That's correct. I probably wouldn't be quite the dramatic picture that I saw when I first started out. But now, you know, you would walk in the operating room, you might see, be watching things on a television monitor and, you know, seeing in-depth anatomy of the human body, you know, through a scope and a, you know, 5-6 millimeter incision. So it would be very different, more than likely.
You know, it reminds me of a television story I did some years ago on a hospital that we were doing a story on, a profile, and the head of the hospital was walking me through. We walked by one of the surgical suites where a man was having back surgery, and he was pretty cut wide open and exposed. And as we left that operating suite, the doctor told me, he said, you know, there is a new, well, not it, but he said there are a lot of doctors now who are performing robotic surgery, and if they were doing that, you would not have seen that man split open, his back exposed. And the point is, when the surgery was over, he'll get a Band-Aid on his back, he'll go back to his hospital room, we'd go home the next day and be practically back to normal in a couple of days. But this chap, he pointed out, it's going to go back to, he's going to be in the hospital several days, and we'll have like 6 weeks of recuperation period. And the point is that he was making, there are a lot of older doctors, it was an older doctor doing the surgery, he had not learned the technique of robotic surgery, and that it really makes a difference of the surgeon you select to do your surgery. And he said, you should think about that. People getting surgery should think about that. And that there's a lot to that, isn't it? Do you advise people about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's a beautiful thing about healthcare, and you know, it's still a scientific field. Treatments, therapies, surgeries are constantly evolving, constantly changing. Things are done differently now than they were 20 years ago. And, you know, to really, I'd say to really be thorough at your job, it's important to stay current with, you know, not only theories, but, you know, with new technology and with newer or improved surgeries and newer ways of performing surgery. The beautiful thing about robotic surgery is, just as you had mentioned, it can lead to a lot of improved benefits for the patient, shorter hospitalization, significantly less pain from the operation, a shorter recovery time, earlier return to normal or full activity. So, you know, I'd say if your doctor's not staying current, then maybe it's time to look for someone who is. That's why there's always options. The old way of doing things is not bad, but, you know, certainly we can improve on that. And I think, that's why there's a standard of care within the community that changes over time, and physicians should adapt to that as well.
Do you think it's more difficult for older surgeons, you know, who've been doing surgeries for many, many years, to learn to use the techniques and actually perform robotic surgery? Is it hard to learn? How do you answer that?
Well, I would say that's a trick question. First of all, define older, because I'm now 57, and, you know, 10 years ago I would have said that I'm old. It's not necessarily harder because, you know, the theory and the concepts are already well built in place, you know, but some of the challenges are the time factor involved. And do you have the time to put to it? So when I first learned to do robotic surgery, it was a technique, wasn't even taught or trained when I was in my residency. But now they started early on in surgery residencies to develop minimally invasive techniques because, you know, the benefits of it are widely known. And so what I had to do was go back and do work in on a simulator, so very similar to a flight simulator for a pilot, you know, where, you know, you're working on a computer, but you're not actually performing an operation on a human being. And then after doing a series of skills on simulators, then in doing theory, then you go into an animal lab or a cadaver lab before you actually do surgery on a human being. So it took between 6 to 8 months to learn all of these techniques. And I would spend anywhere between 2 to 3 hours, I'd say 4 or 5 days a week during that time period, just, you know, honing those skills and learning the techniques involved. When once people are further along in their career, it's not a matter of whether they can do it or not, but whether they have the time to do it or whether they want to put forth the effort to do it, because it does require a significant commitment.
You know, I can't have asked, did you grow up playing video games? Were you adept at that kind of thing as a youngster or not? Or did that come a little later?
You know, it's interesting. That came later. No, I did not. One of the first video games that came out was the old Atari. And I think it just had Pong and then, like, Asteroids. And my parents refused to buy me a video game system, and I would have to go over to a friend's house to play video games. But, you know, then you're always you know, watching your friend play, well, you know, you're not doing much, and then wait for your turn, and it seems like your turn was over pretty quick, and then your friend's playing again. So I didn't grow up playing video games, but then, you know, certainly now I'd say they're commonplace in most households, and I at this point I don't play video games at home. I do it all at work.
I'm just wondering, do you think that's a good training ground for somebody who eventually wants to be a surgeon, a robotic surgeon like you are?
I do. I think it gives you a lot of manual dexterity. There's a lot of controls, much more controls on, say, a normal game controller than what there is on our robot. And it also gets you in terms of that three-dimensional viewing and all of that. So I think it's, you know, it's a good fundamental or a good, you know, basic skill to have, but there's still a lot of theory and education that needs to go along with it.
And let me ask you, what other abilities do you think it's great to have, you know, to be a thoracic surgeon, well, not thoracic, but a robotic surgeon? What talents do you find you know, think are best for someone to bring to the table? Obviously, you're very good at it. You have inbred talents that you bring to the table. What do you think they are?
I'd say one, you got to have patience. And, you know, when you're doing things minimally invasive through tiny little incisions, you're not able to put your hands on things. You tend to take your time and not rush, because if you rush, that's where, you know, injuries can occur, problems can come up. And so I think patience is a great virtue, to just take your time. And if anything, you know, don't rush, slow down through the operation to complete it safely. I think that's a very important skill. And too many times in our society, we want to hurry up and get things over and done with. And so it's important, you know, to slow down the process and take your time and do it carefully and do it correctly. I think it's also important to have a lot of critical thinking in terms of being able to think and adjust on the fly and adapt the operation as, you know, conditions in the patient occur.
What are the most typical kinds of surgeries that are really very, you know, are very good for robotic surgery? Give me an idea of the kinds of surgeries you do, that you do robotically.
Yeah, so I'll tell you what I do, and then I'll tell you what are done in other areas as well. So I am specific on the chest, being a thoracic surgeon. So, you know, I work on the lungs, the rib cage, anything within the thorax. Where I first started doing robotic surgery, I was working with a general surgeon, and we were doing resections of the esophagus for cancer. And very good robotic techniques where you can dissect out the esophagus minimally invasive get a good cancer operation there. I do a lot of lung cancer surgery, lung biopsies, other tumors that occur in and around the chest. Some surgeons, although I haven't started doing this, will do a robotic heart surgery, robotic valve surgery. That probably is another year's worth of training from what I've already done in terms of my practice, and very intense as well. Where you see a lot of robotic training surgery going on is in the abdomen, so hernia repairs, appendectomies, gallbladder removal, colon resections, a lot of periesophageal hernias, which basically where the stomach herniates up into the chest. And then robotic prostatectomy is another very big procedure that's performed a lot. And most of the robotic techniques that I use in the chest started by other surgeons in the abdomen, and then we've just started to apply that to more fields of surgery, you know, as the technology improves.
You know, that's amazing. And what about brain surgery? Brain surgery is done robotically, isn't it?
I don't know that it's done robotically, but there's some things called stereotactic brain surgery. And so, you know, it's very different, but stereotactic surgery allows a neurosurgeon to, instead of doing a large craniotomy and removing a portion of the skull to get to the brain tumor, they might, you know, have a much smaller incision, focus it, you know, in a very narrow area. So it's less invasive per se, but, you know, traditional, like what we do with robotically, you have to have a body cavity where you can insert instruments through a port and then put them into an open space. When we do surgery on the abdomen, we insufflate the abdomen with carbon dioxide, which will distend the abdomen and give you space for the instruments. Don't have that kind of space inside the skull. So using what I'm talking about, which is called the Da Vinci robot, know, neurosurgeons are not doing that, but they have something similar in terms of what they call stereotactic surgery, which is a little less invasive.
You know, one other question, do the surgeries, are they faster if you're doing them robotically? Do you complete the surgery, you know, quicker than you would not doing it robotically? How about that?
Not necessarily. As I mentioned before, I tend to slow down and take my time. I don't rush because, if you get into any troubles, it's much harder to deal with. So it's better to avoid those problems. And so I don't think of trying to get an operation done quicker, but if I can get it done with smaller incisions, then the benefits of, you know, healing faster, less pain, and returning to full activity sooner, you know, those are amplified. So not necessarily faster, but less invasive and less painful.
Well, the patient really benefits. No question about it. There are a lot of benefits for the patient. Interestingly, you don't have to be right next to the patient, do you? I mean, you could be sitting at a table nearby looking at television screens.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
You're actually sitting at a large console about 10 feet away from the patient when you do this. And you have usually an assistant or a physician assistant or a surgical assistant at the table who will exchange instruments for you and do other various tests. So you do need an assistant, you know, at the bedside, but during the operation, you're sitting down at a big console and not even standing next to the patient.
Off the top of your head, what would you say is the most complex surgery you performed robotically? Would it have been on the heart or the lung or what?
Well, the most complex that I do is on the lung, and that would be what we call a lobectomy, which is basically an anatomical dissection to remove, say, a lung cancer.
Right.
I think probably doing robotic heart valve surgery is much more complex, and that's an area that I have yet to venture into, but I'd say probably at some point we'll go in that direction.
Well, this is a fascinating discussion. Thanks for exploring that with us a little. I want to bring up an interesting point about you. You're not just a surgeon. You also have a Master of Jurisprudence in healthcare law, policy, and management that you got from Texas A&M, the School of Law. What drew you to want to get a degree in that? How about that?
This is very interesting, but I think as I, transition towards, I'd say, the second half of my career as a surgeon, you know, I really enjoy my job and I enjoy being in healthcare, but, you know, at some point, you know, our fine motor skills start to deteriorate and I don't want to stop working. And so I looked in other areas of healthcare where, you know, maybe I can still make a contribution. And I was actually hospitalized myself in California several years ago and met the CEO of the hospital where I was at. And he was a pulmonary critical care doctor who had done a 6-month online MBA program and then, you know, worked his way up to the CEO of the hospital. What I found through Texas A&M School of Law was a 2-year program that was tailored specifically to healthcare. So it was entitled Healthcare Law, Policy, and Management and specifically designed towards, you know, a career in management within the hospital setting. My ultimate goal is to be, you know, a leader or administrator, CEO of a healthcare system, and continue to contribute, you know, to patient care, but in a completely different way than what I do now.
Yeah, that would be unique. I would assume the background as a surgeon would be really great background to be the administrator of a hospital. Am I right about that?
I think so. Yeah, simply because, you know, as a surgeon, you live in the hospital. you know the inner workings of the operating room, the entire hospital. I mean, you know, that's where you spend the majority of your time. So I think a lot of healthcare systems have gone towards non-physician leadership. And I think it's hard for administrators who aren't healthcare providers to really understand what goes on, you know, in the operating room or in a patient, you know, care setting. And so what better than a physician for to be in that leadership role? And I'd like to start bringing that back.
You know, let me ask you something. You would know the answer to this. What do you think the biggest challenge facing physicians working in hospital systems would be today? You're there on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's a loaded question. Well, there's several, but I'd say, you know, in terms of, I think one of the challenges is there's too few of us and not enough time to spend with each patient, you know. And, you know, patients now, when they come into the hospital, they don't just have one problem. They have a multitude of problems. And, you know, our society demands a quick fix to things, you know. And it's oftentimes not that simple. And so, you know, during the day, you know, I wish I'd had more time to spend with my patients and can focus on, you know, not just their lung cancer or their heart disease, but other things that contribute to it. But I don't have the time for that and have to leave that up to other providers. So, you know, I'd say that's probably one of the biggest challenges. We just don't have enough time in the day to spend it the way we'd like to with our patients.
Look back for me a little while. When you first decided you wanted to get into medicine and be a doctor, by the way, do you remember what made you make that decision? Did you always want to be a doctor growing up or what? How do you answer
yes.
that?
So, yeah, I was fortunate to have a very good relationship with my pediatrician growing up. He lived up the street from us. He had, I want to say, three daughters that were right about the same age as me, and then he had a son who was much younger. But he liked to play basketball, and I would, you know, sometimes go up and, you know, shoot hoops with him. He would take me when he'd make rounds in the hospital. When I was in college, I got a summer job at a healthcare facility where he was the, you know, the lead physician. It was in a pediatric facility for kids with all kinds of congenital defects. And so I'd say he was probably the first big inspiration in terms of me wanting to go into healthcare. When I was in high school, I had some knee injuries and ended up having surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and I had a very interesting but positive experience at the time of my surgery. I spent about 8 days in the hospital, and I'd say that time really, you know, sealed the deal for me in terms of, okay, yeah, this is definitely what I want to do.
That's very, very interesting. And looking back over the course of what you're doing now in your career, is it all you thought it was going to be? What's it like being a doctor? Do you love it?
Oh, yeah. It's a lot more than I ever imagined. And, you know, because when I was younger and when I was, like, shadowing, you know, the pediatrician, I had no idea the amount of calls they get after hours and at night and all of that and all the time and research involved and how you have to continue to, you know, read articles and stay on top, you know, to be current in your field. And so, you know, I had an idea that it was going to be a life of service and, you know, long hours, but I didn't know what I was getting myself into, but I certainly enjoy it, and, you know, I wouldn't hesitate to do it all over again.
Are you amazed at the kinds of things you're doing that you never dreamt would even be available, the techniques would be available when you went into medical school?
Absolutely. And yeah, looking back when I was in high school, you know, if you'd have told me I'd be doing this kind of stuff, you know, when I'm in my 50s, I wouldn't have believed, you know. So, yeah, I am truly amazed. And I think that's part of what, you know, makes my job so enjoyable.
And as we mentioned before, you entered college, you entered med school by going into the military, and you highly recommend that. I think it's very, talk about that
yes.
for a moment. Tell me.
Yes, so I did what was called the Health Profession Scholarship Program. Three branches of the service provide that, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. I had originally applied for a scholarship through the Navy, but because of the injuries I had had and the surgeries I had when I was in high school, the Navy didn't take me. And I was, you know, a little upset about that because I didn't know how I was going to pay for medical school. And I really didn't want to do the traditional route of taking out student loans and spending the first 10 years of my career paying them back. And I had a good friend who was in the Army ROTC in undergrad, and he said, well, you should apply for the scholarship through the Army. They'll take anybody. Thank God he was right. But, you know, and I didn't know what I was getting myself into at the time, but as it turned out, I went to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. It's a level 1 trauma center for the city of San Antonio. They offer every subspecialty of medicine there, very comprehensive facility. And the training I got was, you know, I'd say it was top notch, you know, just as good as any major, you know, institution in any major university. So, you know, I think I really benefited from that. But as a result, you know, I had no debt when I graduated medical school. All my bills were paid for. I had a monthly
yeah.
living stipend. All my books, supplies, everything was taken care of, you know. And, you know, when you're in the military, you don't have to worry about what clothes to wear. You know, they even tell you that. So it makes it easy.
Oh, that's remarkable. And not only that, but you also served time in Iraq, patching up soldiers who have been injured in the war over there. Great. That must have been great experience,
yes.
too, right?
Yeah, very different from yep. what I do back here in the States. But, your mission as a wartime surgeon is to preserve the fighting force. So when soldiers come in who are wounded, you know, your job is to put them back together so that they can recover and you know, get back out there and fight again. Sometimes their injuries are more devastating than that. But, you know, certainly it was an incredibly rewarding experience. And even though I was in the military for, you know, quite a long time, I just had no appreciation for how powerful the military is until that, you know, you're deployed in a wartime setting. It's just
yeah.
amazing how the military operates under those conditions.
Well, listen, Dr. Upman, it's so great talking to you. You're so full of valid information. Explain for us again where you are now. I know you're in Ohio, but where are you doing your surgeries? Explain.
Right. So I'm in central Ohio, right outside of Columbus in a town called Lancaster, Ohio. It's just east, about 15-20 miles east of Columbus. So it might be considered a distant suburb. We serve eastern and southeastern Ohio. At our hospital, we have just about 200 beds.
Okay.
And we do all kinds of heart and lung surgery and everything else.
And the hospital is? Want to give the name?
Fairfield Medical Center.
Fairfield Medical Center. All right, we have run out of time, Doctor. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been great. You know, they're just interesting hearing you talk about the profession and what you do and what it's like. So thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Dr. James Obney, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you, Dr. Obney. Have a great day. All right, thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Doug.
Bye for
I appreciate it.
Bye for now.